You may proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice and members of the court, may it please the court, my name is Thomas Schultz. I am counsel for the appellants in this case. This case, as the record shows, involves a declaration of specific performance as well as declaratory judgment. With the court's permission, I would like to address five issues in this matter. There obviously are multiple issues in this case. The first issue that I would respectfully address is the issue of the basis, which we say is the sole basis for the trial court's decision. Based on the principles of law set forth in Walker's Executor, Rusty's Welding, the Encyclopedia of Law that we cited, and the Munchmauer case, based on those principles of law, and based on the transcripts in this case, and the trial court, as the record shows, said that the transcripts would control as to the basis for the court's ruling. Based on those principles and based on the transcripts, we respectfully say that the sole basis for the trial court's ruling in this case was lack of clarity regarding specific performance, because the two-acre parcel would change over the approval process. The result of that sole basis for the trial court's ruling results in the restriction in connection with the September 23rd, 2014 order entered by the trial court. This clearly is an unusual situation. In fact, I would say it is probably, I've never been in a case where the court said, you're going to have to tell the Supreme Court the basis for the ruling. The court said it wasn't going to spend 3 or 4 hours reviewing the competing orders. At one point it said it would be a judicial waste of time. What it comes down to under the principles of law, contract law is used in the interpretation of court orders, and ultimately it's the intent of the trial court which controls.
May I ask you this?
Yes,
but
sir.
Specific
yes.
performance is an equitable remedy, and it's an extraordinary equitable remedy which the chancellor has a great deal of discretion on. So the principle of law, whether a contract's too indefinite to enforce for affirmation of damages and law actions, is further encumbered in your case by equity, which says, and chancellors using extraordinary equity remedies have an even broader scope of discretion. Why isn't this case the kind of case where reasonable chancellors could disagree as to whether or not there's enough definitiveness in this contractual relationship to order specific performance? The penalty, a violation of which, would be contempt and sanctions, which is a pretty extraordinary thing to do.
Well, it depends on the issue that the court is addressing and asking about. In connection with the issue of the changing of the two-acre designation over the approval process, which is not in the pleadings, which was based on an admission that I made to the court as an officer of the court, I responded to the court's question. We respectfully say under the Turner broad equitable power and under Cangiano, for example, where, Mr. Chief Justice, you wrote the opinion, where the relief in Cangiano was that the seller would acquire easements and other matters off-site, and that was deemed to be appropriate. In terms of the issue of if there's any ambiguity, as this court said in Grayson Lumber, in fact, citing the Encyclopedia of Law, which we cite, this is long before any of our time, even before my time, that if there is ambiguity, even in specific performance, if there's ambiguity, the court hears evidence, and all that is necessary, and this is in reference to the reasonable description of the property, all that is ultimately necessary is that it be made reasonably certain after the court hears evidence. In the City of Manassas case, sufficiently definite was the ultimate test. You wrote the opinion for the Court of Appeals, Justice Kelsey, in terms of defining, citing the New York Supreme Court case, what it takes for a contract to be declared void for indefiniteness. All those rules apply
No, I don't disagree with you. And the legal definition of indefiniteness for purposes of enforcing a contract at law, which is a damages action, is exactly as you state them. But we have a chancellor exercising equitable remedies. Now the question is this higher level of extraordinary remedy, which is in the nature of an injunction, a specific performance order, can reasonable chancellors disagree as to whether or not there's enough clarity to go to that higher level of judicial authority? And if a reasonable chancellor could see it two different ways and still be reasonable, the abuse of discretion standard requires us to affirm.
Well, first of all, I think we'd have to have a full evidentiary hearing to, in fact, make a judgment on that. But ultimately, as this court said, City of Manassas, sufficient definiteness is the ultimate criteria. You have to know which particular issue the court is talking about. There are ambiguities in the contract. We don't disagree with that. But that doesn't end the issue in terms of specific performance. As this court said in City of Manassas, if you prove the contract, once you've proven the contract, it's just as usable for specific performance as it is for damages.
But aren't you really saying, I mean, even if we accept the allegations of your complaint and your position about how the contract should be interpreted, essentially what you're requesting, if you look at the 42 number paragraphs of your wherefore clause, you want the court to just have general supervision over the contract for the years going forward, for the selection of the lot, and everything else. And after this period of interim decrees over a number of years, then we'd get to the final analysis, which is a final decree conveying the property. That's what you want, right? I mean, that's how I'm reading your...
That's exactly. There are two parts to that question, Madam Justice. The declaratory relief, because there was an anticipatory breach, and because the parties seem to disagree about everything, we've asked the court to make certain interpretation issues or declarations in terms of the contract, whether it's ambiguous or not. If the parties disagree, that's a basis for declaratory relief, number one, so in connection with that aspect. But in connection with your question about retaining jurisdiction, yes. But that's exactly what the court did in City of Manassas, retain jurisdiction. That's exactly what the court did in the Cangiano case. In fact, the Cangiano case involved an order, as I said earlier, for the seller to acquire easements and all off-site improvements in order to satisfy the development requirements, which, quite frankly, is broader than what we're dealing with in this case. Parties have a right to rely on courts enforcing their contracts. It is what makes the world go round. It is fundamental to our system of justice. Contract laws are applied everywhere. And simply because the court's going to have to retain jurisdiction, that doesn't mean that you can't have specific performance, because generally in those cases, a lot of it is going to be retaining jurisdiction, which was in fact exactly what was done, as I say, in the City of Manassas, the recent major cases on specific performance, City of Manassas and Cangiano. So for those reasons, we respectfully say that the court erred in terms of the decision that it was too lacked clarity because the two-acre parcel changed over the approval process. In connection with the grounds for the ruling, we say in the alternative, respectfully, that the trial court abused its discretion and should have set forth in the order, to avoid all this issue about just what was the basis for the decision, that the court should have set forth in the September 23rd order the grounds. And we say it was an abuse of discretion on the motion that we filed that be done, for the court not to have done that. In terms of the other four issues that we respectfully would point out to the court at this point, in connection with the picking of the two-acre lot, at common law, parties have a right to grant to the other parties in a contract the right to select a parcel of a definite size from a definitely described larger parcel of land.
All right, well, let's talk about what the contract says on selection of the lot. It says Section 1 of the contract, right? The lot is supposed to be selected pursuant to the terms of Section 1 of the contract.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you take the position that you have a right to require what goes on the master plan of Tract 1. Do I have that right?
We do, based...
And has any of that happened?
No. The suit was filed. There was never a hearing on the merits. There was a hearing on a demur.
Right. And for any of that to happen, doesn't it require under the contract itself for the two parties to work together and agree?
In terms of the master plan?
Right.
On the issue of the master plan, which is a good point, in the Roe case, we cited the Roe case to this court, where when this is a municipality situation, the Roe case, where the legislature, a law was passed which gave the localities the right to approve or disapprove a subdivision plat. Implicit in that was this court determined and said that implicit in the rule or the right to approve or disapprove of a subdivision plat was the right to require what would be on the plat. In connection with the master plan, which we allege means the site plan, I'll read from the contract, the master plan to be submitted must be approved by the buyer, for the buyer must approve it, which approval should not be unreasonably withheld. Following the rationale in Roe, the buyer, Holtzman Oil in this case, has the right, so long as they're acting reasonably, to say what will be on the master plan, which we say means site plan. So it's not a mutual agreement.
But it's at least subject to further agreement.
Not agreement. The Holtzman Oil, the buyer, has the right to approve or not approve the master plan, site plan. We say that the seller has the obligation to prepare it, but the buyer has the right to approve or disapprove. It won't be submitted to Loudoun County until it's approved by Holtzman Oil.
Where does it say that in the contract, sir? Contract stipulated that the two-acre lot would be chosen at the discretion of the buyer upon the development and submission of a master plan appropriate to the governing body, basically.
Justice Powell, that's a different question than what Justice McClanahan offered or asked.
I'm sorry.
I'll be happy to address that.
Answer hers first and then answer mine.
That's all right. You've answered it. You go ahead and answer Justice Powell.
You're saying that you have the right to approve the plan. Doesn't the language that I just read indicate that the governing body approves it and you then select your two-acre lot?
The two-acre lot is selected first, which we have done.
Correct.
And as common law, the parties in the agreement gave the buyer the right to select the two-acre lot from anywhere within the 30.3-acre tract. And at common law, that's allowed. Parties to a contract, and we cite a whole line of cases which the other side has not in any way challenged.
Did you just say you have selected the two-acre plot?
We have. It's Exhibit 21.
Okay.
We have. It was before the court, and that's what, in response to the court's question, trial court's question, I said, yes, that's likely to change over the approval process. It's an administrative process, and we have VDOT approval and other such things as that. So the court, yes, the court will retain jurisdiction while that process goes on. But the selection, just fell, of the two-acre plat and lot is at the sole discretion of the buyer, Holtzman Oil, which is different from the...
I'm sorry, perhaps I misunderstood you. I thought you said you get to approve the master plan. I perhaps misunderstood.
We do. It's the seller, under the administrative procedures, the seller... the owner of the property is the one who has to submit the applications to the governing body. And they prepare it, we look at it, we say yay or nay. Under the road rationale, we have the implicit right to say we want certain things on there in order for us to give you our approval. And that's implicit in the contract, which is different from the two-acre designation, which we've done. The
Your time has expired. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, my name is Mike Schabelsky. Along with Jeffrey Mervis, we represent the Appalese Green Project and Scott Kasperitz. As Justice Kelsey commented, specific performance is an equitable remedy. No one has a right to specific performance. It is a matter of judicial discretion. It has been described as an extraordinary act of grace on the part of the court. Here, the record is clear that a reasonable chancellor had multiple reasons why an exercise of discretion to decide that the specific performance spanning some 42 numbered paragraphs in the complaint was unreasonable and shouldn't be granted here. First of all, there is the undisputed fact that the plaintiff waited nearly a decade to seek specific performance. The contract here was signed in 2002, and the plaintiffs didn't sue until nearly a decade later in 2011. During that almost 10-year period, Holtzman never called upon the original seller, New Dominion, to perform, nor did it call upon Green Project to perform when it assumed the contract. To the contrary, Holtzman accepted the return of the $600,000 deposit in 2005 and seemingly walked away from this contract. Over the next 6 years, Holtzman made no demands on Green Project to perform. It submitted no plans to Green Project to approve. It had no, essentially, communications at all. It was only 6 years after accepting the return of the deposit and giving all objective signs that it had abandoned the contract that it popped up when it believed that perhaps circumstances had changed and now it wanted this property. That alone provides adequate grounds for denying specific performance. As this court has held many times, a party who seeks specific performance must not sleep on its rights, but must come promptly to the court. He must show that he has used reasonable diligence. As this court has written, the party seeking performance must not have remained quiet or held himself aloof so as to enforce or abandon the contract as events might prove advantageous. That is precisely what is going on here. Holtzman Oil decided he could not develop this property, accepted the return of the deposit, but wanted to have it both ways, to say, I'm under no obligation to buy the property, but I'll wait until events may unfold years in the future when I think now maybe I can develop the property and pop up. That's unfair and certainly is adequate grounds for denying their extraordinary relief they're asking for. In addition to that, there is the other undisputed fact that the contract here does not specify the meets and bounds of the two-acre lot. It is fundamental that a court will not decree specific performance of a contract for the purchase of land when the contract itself does not identify the specific property to be conveyed. It becomes impossible for the court to order specific performance in that circumstance if it can't even describe the property in the deed to be conveyed. The contract here does not define the two-acre lot. It leaves it for future agreement between the parties. It is, in essence, an agreement to agree, which this court has held cannot be specifically performed. And that is fatal to all the multiple forms of relief that Holtzman here is seeking. Because unless and until you can define the two-acre parcel, you cannot then define what are the other obligations that they want Green Project to perform with respect to whatever parcel it is they want.
Well, counsel, your opponent said that he did. They did select it as reflected on Exhibit 21.
I'm glad you addressed that, Justice Lacey, because I was coming right to that. Their contention, rather, is they get to unilaterally select the two-acre lot. What the contract provides in Section 1 is that the lot will be selected following the development, upon the development, of a master plan. The record here is undisputed that no master plan has been developed and agreed upon between the parties. The complaint is replete with allegations that there is no master plan, and in fact, if you look at Exhibits 19 and 20 of the complaint, which appear at Joint Appendix pages 139 and 142, you'll see that the complaint acknowledges there is no master plan. Exhibit 19 was the tendering of a master plan by Green Project, and Exhibit 20 was the rejection of the master plan by Holtzman Oil. The next exhibit, which Council referred to, Exhibit 21, is Holtzman Oil saying, even though we don't have an agreed master plan yet, we now get to unilaterally select the two-acre lot. That's what he is referring to. And moreover, as we even heard admitted today, but as it was conceded below, Holtzman Oil says that two-acre lot that it's now trying to unilaterally select without a master plan is itself a moving target and will continue to move even after the trial they conceded. And that brings us then to the third point, grounds for affirmance here. And that is that the relief that Holtzman is asking for, what they want ordered, far exceeds anything that it is entitled to under the contract. In addition to wanting specific performance of the unilateral right to select a two-acre lot on a rolling basis and continuing basis, which is not provided in the contract, Holtzman seeks the right to encumber the larger 30.3-acre tract owned by Green Project with acres and upon acres of easements outside of that two-acre lot, easements for water, sewer, and other uses, easements to demolish buildings outside the two-acre lot. None of that is allowed and authorized to Holtzman under this contract. In fact, the word easement doesn't appear anywhere in this contract. And with respect to water and sewer in particular, this contract expressly provides that sewer and water must be provided on the two-acre lot. The well must be on the two-acre lot, and the lot itself must support the septic tank. So they're antithetical to this notion of off-site easements here. In addition, Holtzman goes beyond the terms of the contract in wanting a broad relief order that Green Project must do literally everything necessary. I believe those are its words repeated time and time again. Literally everything necessary for Holtzman to obtain building and occupancy permits from the county for whatever building plans Holtzman may desire to have now or in the future. The contract imposes no such obligations on Green Project. Holtzman seeks to divine or create such obligations through the contingency clauses in the contracts, but fairly read, those contingencies are not affirmative obligations on the seller, that the seller must perform and do these things. Rather, since they are, as they are called, contingencies, they are the contingencies that are prerequisites to Holtzman's obligation to buy the property, to close the property. If they don't happen, then, or occur, Holtzman wouldn't have to have bought the property. But to turn them around now and say, a Green Project now must expend whatever resources are necessary, give up whatever property rights outside the two-acre lot are necessary to support whatever whims and desires and building plans Holtzman wants, is not a proper interpretation of the contract. Obviously, specific performance can only be granted for rights that are grounded specifically in the contract. The 42-paragraph request for relief that Holtzman asks far exceeds that. In these circumstances, it would not have been, it's not an abuse of discretion to deny specific performance. I would suggest that it would have been an abuse of discretion to grant specific performance. And then there is the final factor, as Justice McClanahan was pointing out, the relief that Holtzman Oil is asking for here is not specific performance. It was sort of a roving commission in the circuit court to supervise this contract for an indefinite period, for indefinite relief, with all manner of uncertainties about what would be done and what Holtman would want, coming back constantly to court, changing its mind about even what 2-acre lot it wanted. That is improper.
May I ask you this? The request for general performance, as you describe it, was denied, and you got your attorney's fees for the proceeding below. And as I understand cross error one, you're looking for the attorney's fees in the prior discontinued case as well.
Yes, sir.
What is that? How would you outline that argument?
Yes, sir. The attorney's fees clause in this contract, paragraph 9, is very broadly written and provides that in the event of any litigation, any, very broad, obviously means all without limitation, the prevailing party in that litigation is entitled to recover the cost of such litigation. Now, there's no dispute that the first lawsuit, we call Holtzman 1, and this lawsuit, called Holtzman 2, were part of the same litigation. It's the exact same cause of action. There was no dispute or doubt about that below. And there's no dispute that Green Project has now prevailed in this litigation on this claim, on this cause of action that has been the subject of litigation now through two lawsuits. The circuit court, as Holtzman argues here, believe that because Holtzman 1 resulted in a non-suit, that therefore fees could not be recoverable in that action, citing this court's decision in Sheets v. Castle. But there are two very important distinctions here. First of all, Sheets v. Castle, the fee application was sought in the non-suited action, and at the point of the fee application request, there was no prevailing party. Well, now the litigation has continued in our case and has resulted in a prevailing party. Second, in the Sheets case, the attorney's fees provision was much more narrow than in our case. It provided for fees based on prevailing parties in actions or proceedings. So the focus of the attorney's fees provision in that case depended upon who was their prevailing party in a specific lawsuit, an action or proceeding.
Is there anything in Holtzman 1 in terms of work product that was used in Holtzman 2?
Yes, sir. Absolutely. Now, the discovery from Holtzman 1 was expressly incorporated into this order and into this case. And the fees associated with Holtzman 1 discovery were, in fact, awarded. Our cross-assignment went for the balance of the fees associated.
So the fees in Holtzman 1 attributable to the discovery in Holtzman 1 that was used in Holtzman 2 were awarded?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so you went beyond that.
Correct, because it is all part of the same litigation, and we are now the prevailing party in that litigation. And even though, in addition to the discovery, obviously the complaint was a carryover of the complaint. The complaints were the same. The legal arguments are the same. And so, therefore, a lot of the legal work product...
In paragraph 9, a prevailing party provision?
Yes, you have to be a prevailing party in any litigation. And what is the common meaning of litigation?
But wouldn't most lawyers say, most defense lawyers walk out of a non-suit and say, I didn't prevail, it's obviously coming back. This is actually worse than staying in the case and fighting and winning.
Well, I think as a practical, I represented many defendants in lawsuits. When we get non-suited out, we think we've prevailed. But the Sheets decision stands for what it stands. But this context, this case is different because we now do have the continuation of the litigation, the exact same claims or the exact same complaint that have now been fully adjudicated and resulted in determination that Green Project is the prevailing party. And obviously, even beyond the discovery that was used in the continuation of the litigation, the legal arguments are the same, the issues were the same.
Counsel, wouldn't that argument apply to any case that's non-suited? Isn't it generally the same case that's refiled and rebrought? So if we accept your argument, anytime there is a non-suit and the case is refiled, if they have language similar to this, the argument would be, well, we're entitled to the fees from the prior case, despite what she says.
If the attorney's fees provision is broadly written like this one here, unlike the narrow one in Sheets' case, that would be correct. And unless there are some other questions, I would like to see 1 minute to co-counsel for Piedmont Environmental Council.
He has 32 seconds.
My name is Charles Moss. I represent the Piedmont Environmental Council and Christopher Miller Trustee. I am simply going to adopt all of the argument that you just heard. Thank you.
Anyone else from that side want to speak? Thank you very much. The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.